What an incredible privilege to be here with you this morning. Thank you for inviting me and Mariah. And you may not know, but New Hope is such an incredible influence across the world. And Pastor Wayne and his message of releasing dreams has touched an endless number of people. And we're really grateful just to be a part of your community and your story over these days. And I just want to stay in that theme of dream releasers and the possibility of all the things inside of us that are waiting to find their release. It was around 30 years ago when I first stepped into a church and was invited by family to begin to consider the message of Jesus Christ. And I have to admit, it was a little crazy for me, and it felt way outside of anything I was really ready for. And what you do expect in church is to hear about the extraordinary nature of God. And of course, the more you understand who God is and in his incredible nature, the awesome essence of the creator of the universe that just with a word creates light and expels the darkness and creates this complex universe, ever expanding, somehow cohesive and unified with supernovas and black holes and galaxies and solar systems, and creates the complexity of this particular solar system and the atmosphere of this planet and allowing life to emerge. It's not hard to understand why we would marvel at the awesome nature of God. But sometimes we forget that there's another narrative that's really significant and critical in the scriptures. And if you've never stopped to consider this, that you have been created not only in the image and likeness of God, but there is an extraordinary nature of all things human. Now, I know we've messed up the human story quite a bit, and so sometimes when we think about what it means to be human, it is usually the negative reflection of ourselves. You go, well, I'm only human, and we say that as if that's the excuse for messing up in life. And most of the time when we are saying things like, I'm only human, what we're really stepping back from is that we're not living our most humane life. But I know this about every single person here today. There's something extraordinary, something inconceivable, something beyond your imagination inside of you, so valuable and so critical to the human story that God himself has placed that inside of you. But for many of us, that extraordinary nature of our being, that part of us that is our best self, is trapped under the rubble of our failures and our fears, which is why I love the story of Moses, especially through the perspective of Stephen. I mean, Stephen was a man who got to give one message in his life, and then he was stoned. And he was trying to translate the story of God stepping into human history in the person of Jesus Christ to a group of people who were not quite ready to hear it. And so he went back to the story of Moses, and he told the story of Moses, interweaving how God intervenes in human history. And I'd like for us to go there for a moment to talk about the possibility of the extraordinary nature of you. Acts chapter 7. I'm going to begin reading in verse 20. It says, at that time, Moses was born, and he was no ordinary child. For 3 months, he was cared for by his family. When he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him in and brought him up as her own son. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. When Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his own people, the Israelites. He saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. The next day, Moses came upon two Israelites who were fighting. He tried to reconcile them by saying, men, you are brothers. Why do you want to hurt each other? But the man who was mistreating the other pushed Moses aside and said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday? When Moses heard this, he fled to Midian, where he settled as a foreigner and had two sons. After 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush in the desert near Mount Sinai. When he saw this, he was amazed at the sight. He went over to get a closer look. He heard the Lord say, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses trembled with fear and did not dare to look. Then the Lord said to him, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I have indeed seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I have heard their groaning, and I have come down to set them free. Now come, I will send you back to Egypt." Now, most of us here are familiar with the story of Moses, and we understand how it plays out. And sometimes it's hard to actually see a person for who they really are when you know the whole story, when you know the end of the story. But what we have to remember about Moses is that Moses was an incredibly broken and really dysfunctional human being. And maybe that's why I like the story of Moses, because it makes me feel a little better about myself. I mean, maybe you're like me. You felt like in the past you had so much brokenness and so much baggage that you had to carry into your journey that you wondered, how in the world could God ever do anything extraordinary with you? I'm an immigrant from El Salvador. Spanish was my first language. I learned English in the States when I was growing up in Miami. Like many people, I never knew my real father. I have actually two brief memories of my father. One was when he kidnapped me as a little boy and took me to get some ice cream. Another time was in a hotel lobby when a man walked up to me when I was around 5 or 6 years old and told me he was my father. And I was confused and I said, "You can't really be my dad, because if you were my dad, you'd live with us." My mom swooped me away in that moment and said, "That's right. He couldn't possibly be your father." And 30 years later, I discovered that was my one memory of my real dad. I also was confused about who my mom was, because my mom had me and my brother when she was very young and left El Salvador, went to Miami to finish her education and build a life for us. And so my grandparents raised us. And so from my first day of life, I understood really my grandmother and my grandfather to be my parents. And then all of a sudden, at around the age of 4 or 5, my mom comes back into our life and she takes me to the United States. And all of a sudden, I'm in the home of a stranger who I am to call my mom, and I'm no longer with my mom and dad, who now I understand to be my grandparents, who are an ocean away, and I'm an alien, a stranger in a strange land. Well, if that wasn't enough to make my life dysfunctional enough, my mom married someone she only knew a few weeks because she felt obligated to provide for us a father. And so she married a man who was involved in what we would best describe as creative underground economies. Some of you will understand that later, and some of you are Italians, and you understand that right away. And so he took us into a police station one day and convinced the police that we had been robbed and that all of our identifications were taken, and all of a sudden I walked out and I became Irish. My name was now McManus. I lived with an alias for the next 30 years of my life. McManus wasn't my name, McManus wasn't his name. I have really no idea who McManus was. But I spent my life as a confused Latin boy thinking he was Irish. And then, of course, Irwin isn't very Spanish either. Because I went to my grandfather when I was around 9 or 10, and I said, "Papi, I need a good American name." And he had no idea what a good American name was. And he wasn't going to tell me that, but he'd been studying World War II history. So he named me after Erwin Rommel, one of the generals under Adolf Hitler. So I grew up being basically an Irish Nazi with a Latino core. And so maybe it shouldn't be surprising that by the time I was 12 years old, I had my first visit to a psychiatric office and spent months in and out of a hospital, and I have a scar across my stomach where they opened me up doing what they called observatory or exploratory surgery, trying to figure out what was wrong with my body because I was sick so much. But there was nothing wrong with my body. My soul was sick. And due to a series of lies and deceptions and experiences of brokenness and wounding, by the time I was 12 years old, I was barely a fragment of a human being. I disappeared and lost myself in an internal world and began losing the ability to distinguish between the world in my imagination and the world outside of me that others would describe as reality. I can resonate with Moses. He was like so many of us. Our life journey is filled with pain and disappointment, with failure and wounding. But Moses has me trumped. I mean, can you imagine being born into a world where you as an Israelite are a slave to this empire known as the Egyptians? And you just happened to be born in that time in history where Pharaoh was concerned that a ruler would emerge out of these slaves known as the Israelites. And so he sends out a mandate to massacre every boy of that people to make sure he would never have a rival. And Moses' parents could only imagine a future where they put the three-month-old baby into a basket, into the Nile River, entrusting him to the hands of God or to the hunger of crocodiles or to the waves of the river. And he had a better chance of surviving at 3 months in the wild and unknown and uncertain than he did in the certainty of his own home. And if that wasn't bad enough, Moses goes floating down the river and is found by the daughter of the Pharaoh who commanded his execution. I mean, only Stephen King or God could write this story. And she decides to raise Moses up as her own son. And so now Moses, the Israelite, has been, in a sense, abandoned by his family, separated from them, is brought into the care of the daughter of the man who wanted him killed more than anyone in the world. And if you want to add a little more nuance and complexity to the story, she hires Moses' mother of all the Israelites available to be the maidservant to take care of this child that she's raising as her own, which isn't her own, but belongs to the woman who says it doesn't belong to her. And Moses grows up as an Israelite Egyptian, absolutely confused about who he is. And so he's 40 years old the first time we hear about him, which, by the way, means he's still living at home with his mother. And he sees an Egyptian and an Israelite having a conflict. The Egyptian is treating the Israelite. And this is his moment. Moses has a sense of destiny. Moses has this internal voice that says his life must matter, must count. And can you imagine growing up every single day of your life knowing that the people who ordered the massacre of your people are the ones giving you the food you eat every day, the shelter you live in every day, the bed you sleep on, the wealth that you benefit from every single day? Moses lived the life of royalty provided by the people who brought violence and the Holocaust to all of his people. Every single day when Moses would walk the streets, he would be a reminder to every father who lost a son and every mother who lost a son. Moses would be the symbol of the absence of God. Yes, Moses was spared by God, but where was God for all their sons? Moses had a dark and heavy burden to carry. So at the age of 40, when he sees this Egyptian mistreating this Israelite, he tries to intervene. He thinks this is his moment. Moses has such a broken moral compass. His whole sense of self and understanding of how God would work through him was so skewed and distorted that he thought that by killing the Egyptian, he could establish himself as the deliverer and hope of the people Israel. And so he kills this Egyptian, but he knows what he's done. Has jeopardized everything he has, so he hides the body. And the next day, thinking he had secured into a dark place, his worst moment, he sees two Israelites having a conflict, so he tries to step in and become that man, that person that he senses he's supposed to be, that in fact he was born to become. And he says, why would you hurt each other? And one of the Israelites says, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? And Moses knew what he did in darkness had been brought to light. And if we understand Moses to be this hero, this iconic figure that we should emulate and be inspired by, What Moses did next is a reminder to us that he's more like us than sometimes we're willing to recognize. Moses ran for his life. Instead of facing judgment, instead of facing his accuser, instead of standing in the place of justice, he ran for his life into the wilderness of Midian. And Moses, who was an Israelite who became an Egyptian, now becomes a Midianite. Moses, who was the only survivor of a Holocaust and the adopted son of a Pharaoh, now becomes a shepherd in a far-off land, never knowing who he is or why he is. I think there are more of us like Moses than we care to acknowledge. But I love the opening line of the story, though. It's in verse 20 when Stephen says, when Moses was born, he was no ordinary child. I love that statement. I mean, wouldn't you love to have someone say that about you at the end of your life? When you were born, you were no ordinary child. I thought about this. I don't think what Stephen is saying that when Moses was born, there were a unique series of events. I mean, when Jesus was born, there were a unique series of events. Angels, choirs of angelic beings, shepherds, star. There were an incredible series of events around the birth of Jesus, but I don't think that's what Stephen is saying. I actually think when Moses was born, it was a pretty ordinary moment. I think Moses looked pretty ordinary. I think Moses was born naked. I'm pretty certain. Lopsided, disproportionate, giant head, little feet, wrinkly, goopy. I mean, really, when babies are born, they look beautiful to the parents and to everyone else who loves the parents. But really, babies are kind of hideous looking. Let's just be honest. Babies look like a shrunken version of our grandparents. I mean, babies, they have to kind of grow into themselves to look human. And I think when Moses was born, he looked just like every other child. I think there was nothing extraordinary or spectacular about that moment. What Stephen is doing is he is projecting backwards through Moses' life to this certain confession that when Moses was born, he was no ordinary child. But I am convinced of this. There has never been an ordinary child born on this planet. And if no one has ever told you this, when you were born, you were no ordinary child. And in fact, I am certain that of the 7 billion people on this planet and all the billions who have ever lived before or ever live in the future, there is not a single human being that was born an ordinary child. But as certain as I am of that, there's never been an ordinary human being born. I know this. Most of us die tragically ordinary. And most of us live painfully ordinary lives. We have to ask ourselves, how can we have such a great beginning to be born extraordinary and to die so ordinary? I mean, somewhere between our first breath and our last breath, something went tragically wrong. Even physiology tells us that human beings are pretty extraordinary. Maybe you're here and let's say you don't feel like you're very good at languages. Anybody like that? Maybe you barely know English or pidgin or pidgin English. But you're saying, I'm not really a linguist. It's not my ability. And you recognize there's some people just seem to have a linguistic acumen, an ability to learn multiple languages. But I can tell you this, when you were born, you were a linguistic savant. You were more capable of learning a new language at the age of 2 than you are at 42. What happened to you? I can tell you that they could have moved you anywhere on the planet. They could have taken you at 3 months old and moved you to China and you would have learned Mandarin. They could have moved you to India and you would have learned Urdu. They could have moved you to Tokyo and you would have learned Japanese. You could have been taken off to some primitive tribal community in Africa and you would have learned how to click to communicate. And there is no language complex enough to be too difficult for an infant But there are so many languages that are too hard on adults. Somewhere along the way, the extraordinary nature of being human gets lost to the ordinary nature of living this human life. Even when they study the neurological relationship of the human brain to creativity, I think it's around 95% of adults function in what's called convergent thinking, where we think of one answer to every question. There's one solution to every problem. And so when we think in convergent thinking, it's like we see an iron and we go, and it asks a question, what do you do with an iron? You go, well, of course, you iron. There is a question, there's an answer, there's the problem, there's the solution. You iron with an iron. That's convergent thinking. But divergent thinking, if you show a person who thinks divergently, what do you do with this iron? They'll give you 500 different things you could do with an iron. And they hadn't even got to ironing yet. And what they found is that about 5% of adults think in divergent patterns. And about 95% of us think in convergent patterns. So you think, oh, well, that's just the way we're designed. That's the way we're made by God, right? The problem is, before your age of 12, what they found is about 95% of children naturally think in divergent thinking, and only about 5% think naturally in convergent thinking. And so what it tells me is that when you were born, you were a savant. You were a genius. You were a creative machine. It's amazing what a child can do with dirt. It is amazing when you give a child a present and all they want is the box, because their imagination makes that box more interesting than the truck inside of it. When you were a child, you were filled with creativity and imagination and exploration and adventure, and then you did this tragic thing. You grew up. Becoming an adult has become code word for becoming ordinary. I can tell you this, when you were born, you were not ordinary. But I also am certain of this. Everything in life, all the pressure of this world will press against you and try to squeeze the extraordinary nature out of you and leave you with an ordinary, mundane, routine existence instead of the life you were created to live. Shakespeare once said, I thought I would quote Shakespeare, make me more refined. It's my only quote from Shakespeare. So don't ask me for two. Shakespeare said, some men are born great, others attain greatness, till others have greatness thrust upon them. I love this because one, it says we at least get three opportunities to be great. And if you're like me, I'm gonna need more than one. You see, when Shakespeare says some men are born great, what he's saying is some of us are born into greatness. We're born into nobility. We're born into royalty. There are sons of kings and daughters of lords. And there are some people who are born of this royal blood, and they have passed on to them a legacy of greatness. And if you're the daughter of Queen Elizabeth, or the son of a Kennedy, or if you're a Scorsese or a Spielberg in LA, you're just born into greatness. And we see that. I mean, there are sons who take on the occupations of their fathers. And I mean, how many of us have taken on the role of our family? And then you see this legacy passed on. And I don't know about you, but I was just sort of born of humble beginnings. I was not born great. I was not born the son of a king or a lord or a person of great wealth. I'm not related to Einstein. I'm not, related to Schweitzer. I'm don't even know who I'm related to. In fact, my mom would always tell the story about her kids, which reminded me I was not born great. She'd go, oh, Alex, what a beautiful baby with his black curly hair and his black eyes. And Duffy, what a beautiful baby with her red hair and her green eyes. And Lee, what a beautiful baby with her blonde hair and big brown eyes. And Irwin, he looked like a rat. And my mom would tell this story, and it'd really bother me. And she told it more than once. And finally, when I was an adult, I'd say, Mom, this is what you'd always told people. She goes, oh, honey, I didn't mean it the way it sounded. I mean, How else do you mean rat? I just meant you were long and skinny. You know, I have a strange appetite for cheese. And I didn't mean anything by it, but I knew that I was not born great. And what Shakespeare's reminding us is that some of us do not have that natural advantage in life. Let's be really, really honest for a moment. Some people just have a leg up. They're born into wealth. They're born into education. They're born into opportunity. They're born into health. They just get a huge advantage from the first breath. And maybe you're like me. From the first step, it was a struggle to be anything but ordinary. But then Shakespeare says, but others attain greatness. What he's saying is that maybe you're not born of nobility and you didn't have an advantage, but you attained greatness. You worked for it through discipline and resilience, and you had this natural acumen or talent. Have you ever met someone who just attained greatness so early? They were a world-class concert violinist by the age of 11. They were working on physics by the time they were 7. Have you been around those kinds of people? You're just a natural savant in math or music or science, or maybe you're Asian, and you just attain greatness at a very early age. I'm just saying that as a Latino, it doesn't really work for us. And I was surrounded by people who attain greatness. I have 4 cousins, all related, and they're all medical doctors. And family members are all lawyers and doctors and PhDs and MDs. And my brother, who I thought was essentially my age, we're in the same grade all of our lives. He was the fastest kid in the United States in 6th grade. I mean, who needs to be that fast? But he was. And he played quarterback, because he had to play quarterback, because he couldn't just be like a receiver or a tackle. He had to be the quarterback, and he broke all the passing records in our high school conference and had a scholarship to play football. But where is the divine humor in that? To have someone with the same genetic code, but the code didn't work. I had 2 sisters, and they would come home with straight A's all the time. With my sister Duffy, on one of her report cards, the principal wrote, "Our only regret is we don't have anything more to give Duffy except for A's." I mean, get a life. What is the problem with that? And I would beg my sisters, please don't show Mom and Dad the report card today. It's Friday. Give me one more weekend of freedom. And they go, "Oh, why would we want to hold this back? How did you do?" I was a straight D student. I believed in balance. I think showing off is wrong. And I'm pretty certain they passed me every single year just to get me out of the classroom to the next teacher. My last day of high school, walking in to have a conversation with my last teacher, I took in about 20 to 25 short stories I had written that I was supposed to have written throughout the year, and I turned them in on the last day, so she was a little bit upset with me. And she looked at me before I walked out of her room, and she said, "Erwin, have you ever thought about going to college?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, maybe." She goes, "You will never make it." I said, "Thank you." But she wasn't telling me anything new. She was just confirming everything I already knew about myself, that I would never make it. I just floated around and did nothing with my life, wandered aimlessly without any intention or purpose or mission, because every voice inside my head said to me, there was nothing of value inside of me to bring to the world. I even remember when me and my brother both went forward in a church, because we had this sense after we had come to faith that maybe God was calling us to preach the gospel or to go into full-time ministry, and they just would always make these appeals. And one night at the same time, just looking at each other, we both walked forward. And I remember my mom running forward and hugging my brother and saying, "We knew God was calling you into ministry." And of course, my brother, he's this fantastic athlete, incredible leader, super brilliant human being. He just natural charisma, has all the stuff. And my mom just grabbed him and said, we knew God was calling you into ministry. And so I was kind of waiting for my maternal affirmation and hug. And my mom then released my brother, looked at me, she goes, but what in the world is God going to do with you? And in that moment, I thought, that's a great question. What in the world would God do with me? You see, I was the most shy and introverted and reclusive human being you'd ever met. In fact, I saw an uncle about a year ago. He hadn't seen me since I was around 20 years old. And the first thing he said to me, he goes, so do you talk now? I said, what do you mean, do I talk now? He goes, I just remember driving you from Orlando to North Carolina to go to college, and you never said a word. I said, so much inside my head, so much in that little world inside of my brain, but I didn't know how to get it outside of my skin. I knew that I was not born great and that I had not attained greatness. But Shakespeare also said, but others have greatness thrust upon them. I love this. See, what Shakespeare's saying is there are moments in history, moments in life, where a crisis emerges, or a challenge is faced. A moment where ordinary men and women are not allowed to be ordinary anymore. A moment that goes beyond the royalty of your blood or the obvious nature of your talent, where character becomes the foundational virtue of the heroic act. A moment that requires someone to be a person of servanthood and sacrifice. A moment that requires us to rise above our fear and our doubts and ourselves and to live our lives for the good of others. A moment that requires us to live our most noble and honorable and heroic lives. He said, in that moment, greatness is thrust upon you. When you step up into that moment to be the person that you would have never been except that the world, that life, that history demanded it of you. And that's exactly what happened to Moses. Moses lived 40 years of his life uncertain who he was. The next 40 years of his life knowing who he was and being ashamed of it. 80 years of his life running from God, running from his destiny, running from the extraordinary nature, awaiting to be awakened within his soul. And then one day he sees a burning bush, and out of sheer curiosity, he approaches it. And to his surprise, a voice emerges out of the bush, and it is the living God, the creator of the universe, encountering Moses and inviting him on a journey with him. He says, I heard the cries of my people, Israel, the oppression of Egypt. He says, and I have come down to set them free. Now come, I am sending you on my behalf. It was in this moment that greatness was thrust upon Moses. And I know this about you and me. It doesn't matter how we started. And you may feel as if you've lost a lot of ground when you look back on your life, but the moment you open your life to the creator of the universe, the moment you entrust yourself to Jesus Christ, the moment you embrace what he has done for you on the cross 2,000 years ago and die to yourself and give your life to him, in that moment, greatness is thrust upon you. And you are no longer allowed to live an ordinary life. You are no longer allowed to accept that voice inside your head that says that you cannot do something significant, that your life is to be wasted and disposed of. There's something amazing inside of you, something extraordinary inside of you, the most beautiful reflection of the image of God. It is God's gift to the world in you. And the world is desperately waiting for you to rise up to be your most heroic self. There's this passage of scripture that always struck me as a little bit out of place When you read the story of Jesus, you know, all these great miracles of Jesus, the feeding of the 5,000, the walking on the water, the touching the lepers and their cleansed, telling the paralytic to take up his mat and walk, and of course, raising the dead. That's a party favorite. And these are the miracles of Jesus that so distinguishes him. And wouldn't it be incredible if those were just the natural everyday activities of us? Then we would know there's something extraordinary in us, right? We would see the divine nature in us. We would see the image of God in us if we were, well, raising a few dead people every month. Walking on water, that'd be particularly helpful here since you're an island. Because we think that the miracle is in the magic rather than in the essence. But the miracle where Jesus' disciples first believed in him, the miracle that first revealed the glory of God in Jesus, it had nothing to do with the spectacular and everything to do with the essence. It's in John chapter 2. It says, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to a wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, don't you think that's kind of odd? Here's Jesus, the Savior of the world, God himself, born of a virgin. Okay, Mary's the virgin, but they're at a party, they're at a wedding, and she says, "They have no more wine." This seems way below God's pay grade. I mean, this seems way below Jesus' mission. Die for humanity, get more wine for the wedding. They just don't match up. And so Jesus responds the way you would think he would respond. "Woman, why do you involve me?" This is Jesus saying, "What are you talking about? They have no more wine. Why are you looking at me? Send somebody out to buy some more wine." Jesus replied, "My hour has not come. You're involving me in something that isn't really mine to be involved. I am the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. I'm not the winemaker." Jesus' mother ignores him completely, says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you," which makes me feel much better about my relationship with my mom. Not even Jesus would get his mom to listen to him. And by the way, if you're here and you revere and respect Mary, this is the only commandment that Mary ever gives: do whatever he says. And so it goes on. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding some 20 to 30 gallons, a lot of water. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." And there are so many nuances here that we're not going to get into. I just want to move to the singular point. And so they did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servant who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests had had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now." I love this. Jesus turns water into wine, but the master of the ceremony had no idea that he had done that. He had no idea there was divine intervention. He had no idea there was a miracle that had taken place. He simply tasted the wine, and it was the best wine he'd ever tasted. And so he knew something extraordinary had just taken place. See, I think for most of us, if we were there, we would have gone, no, you have to understand, water, wine, water, wine. We would have T-shirts, formerly water, now wine. Because we'd have to make sure that people knew it was a miracle, otherwise the wine itself wouldn't hold up. You see, a lot of us try to pretend there's this huge miracle and shovel out cheap wine. It's a tragedy that the word Christian in front of things has become a descriptive of below average. In LA, they talk about Christian films and Christian music and Christian art as another way of saying cheap, low quality, uncommitted to beauty. It shouldn't surprise us that God himself, creating out of his essence, would only create the best wine ever tasted. And it struck me that this is exactly what God does inside of us. This is God's process. You see, in that sense, all of us are water. And by the way, water is essential for life. And it is the presence and activity of God that turns us into wine. And if you've actually been translated from water to wine, you don't really have to do much except let people experience the wine. Just pop the cork, let them smell the aroma of the wine and stir it up in their little fancy glass and take a taste of the wine of your life, and they will know there's something different inside of you. The best way to prove that God exists is to live life at the level that only God can create. I started a company with my family a couple of years ago. We moved into the world of fashion and film, and I have to tell you, when I first started writing and directing, I felt as if I was just stepping into this extraordinary sweet spot, and it felt as if God had created me to do this all my life, and I can't even explain how sacred the experience was for me. But like every filmmaker, I began with whatever I had at hand, and I started making short films, and I started making documentaries, and you're always trying to move toward that feature film and earn the right and credibility to produce that larger story that would hit a broader audience and bring people into a story that provokes their most heroic self. And I got a call about 3 months ago from a producer saying, it's time for you to start making feature films. And it made me very, very nervous. I didn't know this person extremely well, but they set up some meetings at a huge production company. And so I went there and we had an hour and a half, 2 hour long meeting about filmmaking and storytelling. And they seemed to be really committed to moving forward and making a movie together. But I still was sort of living in this disbelief that this could really happen so quickly. And I got a call about a week later saying, we want you to meet with one of our investors. He invested several million dollars in another film just a year before, and he's looking for a new film to invest in, and we want you to meet him. And so I had to drive up to Beverly Hills to his 30-acre home. I didn't know you could have 30 acres in Beverly Hills. And so I drove up to Beverly Hills, and when I went through the first security gate to the second security gate, I thought, wow, they need a lot of security in Beverly Hills, a lot of criminals in Beverly Hills. And then I drove up to his place, and I walked in, and the first thing he says is, I have a meeting at 1:30 with CAA. You get 45 minutes. Let me tell you, it felt cold as ice to me in there. I'm used to, like, cappuccinos and scones, become friends, enjoy each other, aloha, you know, None of that. There was no lays or anything. And my heart was pounding against my chest. I sat in the coffee shop right before that meeting and wrote 11 different treatments or so for 11 different film possibilities in case they asked me, which they never did. And I sat there, and one producer started talking about why he should invest in a film that I would write and direct, and another producer started talking about why he should invest in a film I would write and direct. And I thought, oh, this is nice. I'm not having to do anything. And then finally, there was that awkward silence waiting for me to say something. And I said, you know, I either like to share a meal with a person, or I come bearing gifts. And so I pulled out some of my books and a few of the films that I've worked on. And I said, so I come bearing gifts. And I said, here are a few things you can watch later. And I knew they all had like a faith narrative in them, but I thought he'd look at them later. Because I got to tell you, I told myself before I went to the meeting, he doesn't know that you've been a pastor. Like, he doesn't know that you're a Christian. He doesn't know, you know, about your relationship with God, Jesus. You can just be a writer-director. Maybe you can actually make a feature film. And so I kept telling myself, I got to keep it out of the room. I just can't let him know. You guys never think like that, right? This is just me. And I'm just telling you, when you're in L.A. and someone says, what do you do for a living? And if you say you're a pastor, it is like saying, I'm a cannibal. Do you want to have lunch? So I'm trying to avoid that awkwardness, and I think I get a fresh start here where they don't really know my story. And about halfway through, he pulls up one of the films, and it was this film called Earth that we brought here today. And he said, tell me about this one. I said, oh, that one. Yeah, let me tell you about that one. I said, it's based on the story of Solomon, which I know was sort of riding the line of him being suspicious because it comes from the Bible, but I did think to myself, but Solomon is Jewish, and so it's okay, because in Hollywood, Jewish is okay. And so it's based out of the writings of Solomon, where he said there's nothing new under the sun. And he said, well, do you agree with that? I said, no, I think Solomon was wrong. I think it was Solomon's worst day. I think there is something new under the sun. He goes, well, then explain why our lives are so mundane. I said, oh, okay. Well, you see, if you live your life outside of, and I realized what the next word would be. It was going to be God. I said, darn it. But I was already in. And so I said, if you live your life outside of God, there is nothing new under the sun. Your life becomes routine and mundane, and you're in this endless cycle of repetition. But if you live your life inside of God, He makes all things new. And there's creativity and beauty, imagination. It's the difference between living in the created order, being trapped in it, or living in the creative order. And I got real quiet thinking to myself, he's not going to make a movie with me. And he looked at his producer, he says, that makes sense to me. Does that make sense to you? He goes, yeah, it makes sense to me. And we're all like, yeah, it makes sense to all of us too. And he goes, hey, would you ever be interested in like talking about this stuff, like spiritual stuff? I'm really interested. And I looked at him, I said, even if we don't make a movie together, I'd love to talk to you about spiritual things, even if we don't make a movie together. And like I said, and my 45 minutes were up, got up across the room, walked right over to me, and he said, hey, how about tomorrow? Can we talk tomorrow? I'll meet you anywhere, but you can come up here to the house. We can just talk tomorrow. Because, you know, pastors, we don't do anything during the week, you know, so I didn't have anything planned. And so I moved my schedule around, drove back up to his place. We walked for 2 hours around his beautiful campus. And he looked at me and he said, look, when you walked into the room, I thought, oh no, he saw my fear. Because when you walked into the room, you had this unexplainable peace. And I just wanted to know where it came from, because that's what I need in my life. See, if you're just water and you're pretending to be wine, once they open the bottle, they know you're just water. But if God has taken the water of your soul and turned you into wine, don't let them pop the cork, because they're going to know very quickly there's something different inside of you, because God is present. I didn't want him to know, but he knew. And we walked for these 2 hours, and we sat by his sand volleyball court where his friends like Ashton Kutcher and Gerard Butler come and hang out. And I thought, this is my second day with this stranger. And I look at him and I say, you know what you really need is Jesus. I thought, man, Jesus, you have a way of imposing yourself on my life all the time. And he said, you know, maybe that's why he brought you into my life. He emailed me this morning. We've become really good friends as we've been on this faith journey together. See, what I want you to know is that you may not realize it, but when you entered a relationship with Jesus Christ, he turned the water into wine. But you may be acting like you're still water, sparkling water, Perrier, but you may not really understand that there is more inside of you than you may know, and the world desperately needs the best of you. In fact, the world needs your most heroic self. I know at New Hope you have a theme of dream releasers, and I bet you hear that theme all the time. At Mosaic, we kind of have a theme of awakening the hero. And in fact, my wife, Kim, she gets so sick of that theme. Because if you go to our house, we have posters of Gladiator and Braveheart and Last Samurai. I have an exact replica of William Wallace's sword hanging in my house, with Latin overneath saying, to live as Christ, to die as gain. My wife is very gracious with me. I used to have posters of Spider-Man and all these different superheroes, and I try to get her to go see all the superhero movies with me, but she won't. She just hates them. I go, honey, come, let's go see The Adventures, or let's go see Thor, or Hulk, or Captain America. And she's like, I'm just sick of superhero movies. She goes, how can you not be sick of them? I said, because I'm never going to get sick of a movie that inspires me to live my most heroic life. So one day at Mosaic, she said, could you just stop talking about the hero inside of us? It's just too much pressure. People just don't know what that means. And then one day I saw it. I saw exactly what it means. See, because I think a lot of us are waiting for some radioactive spider to bite us. Or to find out we are actually from Krypton and we can leap tall buildings in a single bound. And yet the proof, the evidence of every day makes us feel extraordinarily human, doesn't it? But I was traveling a lot, and I flew in one night, and Kim and Mariah, my daughter, grabbed me, and they said, "Tonight you're ours," which I knew meant we're going shopping. And so we went to this huge department store that's all for women, and they have a men's room, and that's about it. And they did their shopping. I trailed behind because I knew what they really missed was my wallet. And we're finally at the counter to pay for all their swag and all their stuff. I was kind of bored, and so I started listening into the conversation of the people in the next aisle. Have you ever done that? No, you don't look like eavesdroppers. It was this elderly couple, maybe in their 80s, and the woman looked at the man behind the register, and she said, "Excuse me, I need to buy this teapot, and I'm wondering if you have a discount." And the guy immediately responded, "Lady, if you have our store's card, you're going to have 30% off." And she starts looking in her purse. I thought, oh, man, she must have the card. And she rummaged around and finally looked up. And she goes, no, I don't have your store's card. But I wonder if you have any other discount. And he just said the same thing. "Lady, like I told you, if you have our store's card, you can have 30% off." And he said it with such callousness that it just cut against my soul. And then all of a sudden, she begins to tell him a story. And I know what she was thinking is, if I can bring him into my story, maybe he'll understand and find a way to help me. She goes, "No, you don't understand. I nearly burnt my daughter's house down. She's really upset with me, and I need to buy the teapot. I need to replace her teapot. Do you have any other discount?" And he responded just as quickly, "Like I told you, if you have our source card, you can have 30% off." I just couldn't take it. I know I wasn't supposed to get involved. It wasn't my business. It wasn't my aisle. And I looked at the register. It was around $38 and some change. And so I reached into my pockets, and I found a $20 bill. I thought, I'm almost there. And so I tapped Kim. I said, "Honey, do you have a $20 bill? And I was surprised. She just reached into her purse and handed me a 20, which is one of the signs that God was in this, because she never gives me money without asking me why. And you understand. And now I had $40. I could solve the problem. And so I, the guy was right behind me, right next to me. And I just tapped him, and I said, "Excuse me." And he looked surprised. I said, "I'd like to buy that teapot for them." And he looked at me, and he said, "I'm sorry, sir. You're not allowed to do that." And that really confused me. I mean, maybe he was confused, but I was even more confused. And I thought, oh, I'm not communicating this effectively. And I held up the money, visual aid. And I said, "No, you don't understand. I want to buy the teapot for them." And he looked right across past me to the other cashier, and he says this, "Hey, he's not allowed to do that, is he? He can't just buy the other customer's item." Who sets a policy? No generosity among strangers. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen here, and I thought, what about if she says it is against company policy? What about if I'm standing between the two stupidest people in the world? So I better move fast, and I thought, it's the wrong location. I need to be where the customer is. So I left our counter and went around to their counter. And the woman was just so embarrassed. The man was humiliated. Everybody in the store was watching them. She goes, no, please, I'll buy the teapot myself. And she starts looking in her purse for money I know she doesn't have. And I just looked at her, and I just said, "You'd make me so happy if you would just let me buy you this teapot." And I couldn't even make eye contact with her husband. I felt so ashamed that this is where humanity has come to. And then I leaned over the counter, made eye-to-eye contact with my nemesis. And 30 years of studying communication all had to come to bear in that moment. See, I've spent my life studying human communication. of how human beings communicate on multiple visceral levels. See, I remember one time when I had been gone for a while and I came home from a trip and my friends called me up and said, Irwin, do you want to play basketball? And I said, hey, honey, would it be okay if I go play basketball with the guys? And she said, yeah, sure, go right ahead. That she wasn't really saying, go play basketball with the guys. I know that you need that exercise and that male bonding, and I'll be here waiting for you patiently as your loving wife who made vows to care about you more than myself. And I knew she wasn't saying that. I knew what she was saying by, yeah, sure, you go right ahead, was you're going to be sleeping in the living room for the next 4 to 5 days. I hope you enjoy your basketball, because just asking gets you in trouble. And so I've learned about layers of communication. Now that I need to communicate with this guy at a deeper level. And so I reached across and I said, I'm going to buy the teapot. But my years in Miami helped me translate that. Because he knew what I was saying was, I'm going to reach across and grab you by the throat. I'm going to smash your head against this table 4 or 5 times. It's going to feel really good. And because I'm a Christian, later I'm going to ask Jesus to forgive me. And he's going to. If David can come back with 1,000 foreskins, I'm okay. And I'm going to buy the teapot. And he goes, oh, okay, fine. And then I look at the woman and I just said, you have a great day. I try to end the awkwardness by leaving quickly, and me and Kim and Mariah got into our black van, and it was pouring down rain outside. I have to tell you, I felt as if the entire universe was weeping at the human condition. And then I saw her step outside, and her husband had gone to get the car, and she was holding this little bag with a teapot inside, and she was shaking, and she was crying. I wanted so badly to jump out of the car and go and console her, but in LA, a Latino getting out of a black van is just not a comforting moment. And so I looked at my wife, Kim, and I said, honey, would you go? And she said, of course. And she jumped out of the car and ran through the rain. And then I watched from a distance, through the tears of the universe, two strangers come together. And I watched this elderly woman put her head against my wife's chest and begin to sob and weep uncontrollably as my wife put her arms around her and held her as if they had known each other all their lives. And when Kim came back to the car, I asked her, what did she say? And Kim said, she explained how her and her husband used to own their own restaurant. They could buy whatever they needed. But now their lives have come to this. And as I walked into the car, Kim says, you just kept saying, God bless you, God bless you, God bless you. You know, maybe we didn't change the world that night. We didn't solve the global crises or end some historic war. But I have a feeling in that moment, we were exactly the hero that they needed. And I know this for you and for me. No one may ever write the story of your life or make a film. You may never be known as a historic figure who represents heroism. But every single day that you choose to war against the ordinary and live the extraordinary life that God created you to live, every day that you choose to step into the greatness that's thrust upon you, every day that you choose to live as an expression of the life and love of God, that day, you are a hero to someone, and this world needs you to live that heroic life. God bless you.